Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The Omicron COVID-19 variant has been reported in 77 countries, and the reality is that it is probably in most countries. That's the message from the head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who on Tuesday warned that even if Omicron does cause less severe disease, the sheer number of cases could once again overwhelm unprepared health systems. Tedros also maintained that the World Health Organization was not against booster vaccines, but rather vaccine inequity. Our main concern is to save lives everywhere, Tedros said, adding that every country's priority must be to protect the least protected, not the most protected. According to the WHO, 41 countries have still not been able to vaccinate 10% of their populations, and 98 countries have not reached 40%. Tedros warned that if this situation continued, the pandemic would not stop. To the Human Rights Council, which heard on Wednesday how fundamental freedoms in Ukraine have been squeezed in government-controlled areas, as well as across the contact line in eastern territories held by mainly pro-Russian separatists. Amid increasing international tensions on the issue of Ukraine, UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada al-Nashif also told the Council that similar violations continue to be documented in the Crimea, which has been temporarily occupied by the Russian Federation, she said, since 2014. Here she is now describing the situation in the non-government-controlled East.
In November 2019, an entrepreneur was detained in the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic for publicly expressing his pro-Ukrainian views. He was held incommunicado for 3 days and later sentenced to 13.5 years in prison.
Among member states' concerns at the Council, the European Union called for access to the whole of Ukraine, while Belarus warned that between 4 and 10 million people had fled the country amid increasing poverty. The United Kingdom urged Russia to end its threatening and destabilizing behavior amid a military buildup on Ukraine's borders, while Russia noted with concern the closing down of Russian-language TV channels and the stigmatization of those working for Russian-speaking media. COVID-19 contributed to making more than 50 million people in the Asia-Pacific region more food insecure during the first year of the pandemic, UN agencies reported on Wednesday. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization and UN Children's Fund UNICEF, more than 375 million people in the region faced hunger in 2020, up by 54 million on 2019. Both agencies said that high levels of poverty continue to hold healthy diets out of reach for 1.8 billion people in the vast region. Hunger and poor nutrition levels in Asia and the Pacific in 2019 were already concerning, but the pandemic has made this drastically worse, UNICEF and FAO insisted, before adding that even countries that had initially reported a limited number of COVID-19 cases had suffered the negative effects of containment measures. Combating and eradicating food insecurity and malnutrition by 2030 are key Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression?
It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you there.
It'll be coming up in the second hour of the TaxCast with Naomi Fowler.
right now.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Dean Erwin Chemerinsky about his new book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. This book examines the ways in which the Supreme Court has enabled police violence and killing against people, particularly people of color.
We're also going to be speaking with a water protection attorney, Pat Handlin, on a terrible environmental crisis in northern Minnesota.
A Canadian company is running an oil pipeline of filthy oil that's ruining the environment, that's affecting the Native Americans in northern Minnesota. Stay tuned.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. Dean Chemerinsky is a prominent constitutional law scholar and teacher who has an uncommon ability to explain complex legal concepts so that non-lawyers can easily understand them. A study of legal publications between 2016 and 2020 found him to be the most frequently cited U.S. legal scholar. He is the author of 14 books, including leading casebooks and treatises about constitutional law, criminal procedure, and federal jurisdiction. Dean Chemerinsky also handles legal cases and has argued several times before the U.S. Supreme Court. After a 2000 review of the Rampart scandal about corruption and excessive force in the Los Angeles Police Department attributed them to a few bad apples, Dean Chemerinsky conducted an independent analysis which uncovered systemic and structural problems in the department. In his new book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, he writes, quote, "Race has infected policing in the United States since its founding," unquote. People of color are more likely than whites to be stopped, arrested, and subjected to police violence. Dean Chemerinsky cites the slave patrols, which tracked and returned runaway slaves. We saw the three men who killed black jogger Ahmed Arbery use the logic of those slave patrols in their defense. Due in large part to a video of the killing, they were convicted of murder. When I served as a commentator for CBS News during the O.J. Simpson trial, the people at KNX Radio called Erwin, who did frequent commentary, the nicest guy in the world. He is most generous in sharing his expertise. I can't remember any time he has turned me down when I have asked him to speak at an event, even if it required traveling to San Diego. I have often said that if I were President of the United States, Erwin would be my first choice for a justice of the Supreme Court. Unlike most members of the court, he would be a justice in the true sense of the word. Attorney Jim Lafferty and I are fortunate to have Dean Chemerinsky with us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Erwin.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction and the kind words about the book. It's wonderful to be talking with you.
A fantastic book, which I wish I had for my students to read when I taught criminal procedure before I retired from teaching. First, we would like to briefly get your take on the oral arguments in the Supreme Court about the Mississippi abortion case. What do you think the right-wing majority will do? Will they overrule Roe v. Wade?
I was very discouraged by the oral argument in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization on December 1st. I think it's clear there are six justices on the court to overrule Roe v. Wade. Perhaps they will do so explicitly in this case. Perhaps they will do so by upholding the Mississippi law that prohibits abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy and leave for future cases to directly overrule Roe versus Wade. But there's no doubt after the oral argument that the six conservatives are going to overrule Roe.
Studies have shown that pretextual stops are a common early precursor to police killings and excessive force, even torture against black people. The use of force is not commensurate, that is, with the level of risk that police face during traffic stops. Please discuss how the Supreme Court legalized these pretextual stops.
The crucial case was in 1996, Wren versus United States. What was involved here was some undercover D.C. police officers driving around. They said that they saw a car stop at a stop sign for an unusually long amount of time, about 25 seconds. They said that this was, quote, a high crime area. That was a euphemism for a predominantly minority community. In D.C., police officers are not supposed to enforce the traffic laws when they're undercover officers. Nonetheless, these officers followed the driver until the driver committed a minor traffic infraction, turning without a signal. They then pulled the car over for that, ordered the driver and the passenger out, searched the area of the car that the driver and the passenger had been in, and found drugs. There's no doubt that the traffic stop was a pretext. The officers wanted to search the car for drugs. But the Supreme Court unanimously held that the motive of the officers didn't matter. All that mattered was there was reasonable suspicion that the drivers had violated traffic law. I heard a police officer once say that if he followed any driver for about 15 minutes, the driver would violate some traffic law. Go a mile over the speed limit, turn without a turn signal, not stop long enough at a stop sign, which means we've given the police the power to stop anyone virtually any time they want. And as you pointed out, what we know is that the police use this power disproportionately against people of color.
Police routinely target black people based on racist associations between blackness and criminality. How has the Supreme Court enabled racial profiling through stop and frisk, which triggers racially disparate rates of arrest and deadly violence against people of color?
In part, as I just said to Jim, it's that the Supreme Court has allowed pretextual stops, and this leads to racialized policing. But more generally, in 1968, in Terry versus Ohio, the Supreme Court said that police don't need probable cause to stop someone or to frisk them. The Fourth Amendment says any time the police stop or search somebody, there's supposed to be probable cause. But quite tragically, the Supreme Court said only reasonable suspicion, a much lower standard, need be met. And what we know is, from statistics in city after city, that the police use the power to stop and frisk in a racially disproportionate way. It is used far more against black and brown people.
No-knock warrants are certainly a product of the war on drugs and have led to the murder of, well, Breonna Taylor, among many others. Dean, what are no-knock warrants, and how has the Supreme Court legalized them?
A no-knock warrant is where the police can enter a dwelling without knocking or announcing their presence. And this is dangerous for the officers and for everyone in the residence. When the police enter without knocking and announcing, there's no way for the people in the dwelling to know who it is who's coming in. And as a result, they may pick up a gun, and then the police, seeing the gun, can start shooting. That's exactly what happened in the murder you referred to of Breonna Taylor. The police had a no-knock warrant. They entered in the middle of the night. The man who was there with Breonna Taylor had no idea that it was the police. He thought it was an intruder. He picked up a gun to protect them. The police officer saw the gun, started shooting, and a bullet killed Breonna Taylor. Thankfully, some jurisdictions are now prohibiting no-knock warrants. There's an effort to restrict them at the federal level, and I think this is just a law enforcement technique that is so much more dangerous than beneficial.
There is a pattern of excessive and disproportionate force by police against people of color, and this includes the use of chokeholds and tasers and other things like using automobiles as weapons, etc. How has the Supreme Court enabled all of this?
In so many ways, the court has done that. In fact, I begin the book, the story of the Supreme Court case from 40 years ago, City of Los Angeles versus Lyons. Adolph Lyons was a 24-year-old black man in Los Angeles. He was stopped by police for having a burned-out taillight. An officer ordered him out of the car. The officer slammed Lyons' hands above his head under the roof of the car. Lyons complained that the keys he was holding were cutting into the skin of his palm. An officer administered a chokehold on Lyons. The officer put his forearm around Lyons' neck and squeezed until Lyons was unconscious. He awoke. He had urinated and defecated. He was spitting blood and dirt. The officer gave him a traffic ticket for having a burnt-out taillight and let him go. Lyons did some research and discovered at that point 16 people in Los Angeles, almost all like him, black men, had died from police use of the chokehold. He sued to have the use of the chokehold in these circumstances declared unconstitutional. He wanted an injunction to stop the LAPD from using the chokehold, except if necessary, protect the officer's life or safety. But the Supreme Court, 5-4, said Lyons could not sue. He didn't have standing because he could not show that he personally was likely to choke again in the future. Well, no one can show that he or she is likely to be choked again in the future, so no one will ever have standing to bring a challenge. And that's true whether we're talking about the chokehold or the taser or other abusive police procedures. If the Supreme Court in Lyons had declared the chokehold unconstitutional, maybe George Floyd and Eric Garner and others who died from it would still be alive today.
Irwin, thank you for that sad story. Derek Chauvin was recently tried and convicted of murdering George Floyd. But how common is it that police officers are charged with crimes for killing black people?
It's uncommon for police officers to be convicted. In fact, had there not been someone who took a video, I doubt that Derek Chauvin would have been convicted. Usually what happens, it's the word of the police officer against the words of those who observed what happened, or if the victim survives, the words of the victim. And juries tend to give great deference to police officers. So the simple answer to your question is, it is very hard to convict a police officer, or even indict a police officer, for excessive force.
Irwin, prosecutors have unfettered discretion whether or not to bring charges, and they often manipulate the grand juries when they do bring cases to them. For example, when public outrage leads to the necessity for the prosecutor to go to the grand jury, but the prosecutor purposely subverts the case so that the grand jury doesn't indict ultimately. Now, police officers have qualified immunity, which they raise as a defense in civil cases. What is qualified immunity, and how has the Supreme Court facilitated that defense?
We were talking a moment ago about how difficult it is to criminally prosecute police officers. Qualified immunity comes up when there's a civil suit against a police officer. Whenever any government official is sued for money damages, the Supreme Court has said the officer always has an immunity defense. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution, there's nothing in any federal statute about immunity defenses. It's made up by the Supreme Court. Some government officials have absolute immunity, which means they can't be sued at all for their constitutional violations. Prosecutors for their prosecutorial tasks, judges for their judicial acts, police officers when they testify as witnesses, have absolute immunity no matter what they do. For all who do not have absolute immunity, they have qualified immunity. And the Supreme Court says this means that they can be held liable for money damages only if they violate a clearly established law that every officer should know. It has to be a right established beyond debate. And the Supreme Court has said repeatedly, as recently as October, that qualified immunity exists to protect all but the plainly incompetent officer. And in case after case involving excessive force, including two in October, the Supreme Court protected police officers by qualified immunity when they engaged in excessive force.
Dean Chemerinsky, the Warren Court, and that's been quite some time now, is the only time that there was a solid liberal majority on the court. Briefly explain how each successive court the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, and now the Roberts Court, has enabled police misconduct and eroded the rights of people suspected of committing crimes.
You're absolutely right that the Warren Court was the only time in history when there was a liberal Supreme Court. And actually, though the Warren Court was from 1953 to 1969, it was only from 1962 to 1969 that there was a liberal majority on it. And during that time, the court did more to protect the rights of criminal defendants and criminal suspects than the Supreme Court has in all of American history combined. It was then that the Supreme Court said that those who are tried for a crime in state court where there's a possibility of a prison sentence have a right to a government-provided lawyer. Isn't it amazing that from 1791 until Gideon v. Wainwright in 1963, a person could be tried and convicted in state court and sentenced to life in prison without needing to be provided a lawyer? In 1966, in Miranda v. Arizona, the Supreme Court said that police questioning of a person in custody is inherently coercive. To lessen the coercion, the police have to provide the warnings that we're all familiar with. In 1968, the Supreme Court said, if somebody has been indicted and there's a police lineup, the indicted person has a right to have an attorney present to try to prevent the police from engaging in manipulation or suggestive eyewitness identification. But in 1968, Richard Nixon ran for president against the liberalism of the Warren Court. He said he was going to appoint law and order justices, and he got to appoint four justices in 2 years. And that created the Burger Court. And then the court became even more conservative when, in 1986, President Reagan nominated William Rehnquist to be Chief Justice. And the court's become even more conservative with John Roberts becoming chief in 2005, and, of course, the addition of three Trump justices to the court. What have they done? Well, with regard to the Fourth Amendment, the court has made it much easier for police to search any person virtually any time, such as the Wren case in 1996 we talked about. There aren't many remedies for violation of the Fourth Amendment, and the Supreme Court has largely gutted them. The Supreme Court has gutted the exclusionary rule that says that if police violate the Fourth Amendment and engage in illegal search, the evidence is to be suppressed. The Supreme Court has made it very difficult to sue police officers or local governments for money damages when they violate the Constitution. With regard to the privilege against self-incrimination, the Supreme Court has created many exceptions to the requirement to give Miranda warnings, and the Supreme Court also has very much lessened the protections that exist when somebody's Fifth Amendment rights are violated. One of the most egregious things the Supreme Court has done since the end of the Warren Court is largely ignore the problem of eyewitness identifications. Study after study has shown that people who are exonerated who had been wrongly convicted, this when DNA shows that they were innocent, were convicted on the basis of false eyewitness identifications. Social psychologists have documented that especially cross-racial eyewitness identifications are likely to be inaccurate. Despite this, since 1986, when William Rehnquist became Chief Justice, there was only one Supreme Court case that's even addressed the issue of eyewitness identifications, and that ruled in favor of the police. And the point of my book is that when you put all of this together, the Supreme Court has empowered the police, subverted civil rights, and very much empowered racialized policing in the United States.
Since the murder of George Floyd, there have been calls for defunding of the police, even abolition of police. Do you favor this, or do you prefer reform, which has been relatively unsuccessful in preventing police abuse? And if you do support reforms, what reforms do you advocate that we need?
I don't think abolition of the police is possible or is desirable. I understand the impulse for it, especially in communities of color. But every society needs law enforcement. In fact, I recently saw a survey that showed that only 12% of black Americans favor abolition of the police because they, like all of us, want to live in safe communities. And if ever abolition of the police was possible, I think the current increase in violent crime makes it implausible. Besides that, I think it would only make the situation worse. those who have money would hire private security forces to protect them. And those private security forces, because they're not the government, wouldn't have to comply with the Constitution. So I think there is no choice but reforming the police. And I think I disagree with the premise. I think there can be successful police reforms. Let's take Los Angeles as an example. After it was sued by the United States Department of Justice 20 years ago, during a pattern and practice of civil rights violations, the city entered into an agreement with the Justice Department to reform policing. The agreement, called a consent decree, is over 100 pages long. It did so many important things. It created a system for tracking disciplinary violations of officers. It required officers to record the race of those who they stopped. It changed how use of force was investigated. A study by the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard showed a dramatic decrease in use of force, especially against people of color, while the consent decree was in effect. After the tragic death of George Floyd, many cities in some states like California prohibited the use of the police chokehold. I think there is so much that needs to be done to reform policing in the United States. I think we need to change how police can engage in search and arrest. I think we should eliminate the ability of police to stop or frisk people on the basis of reasonable suspicion. I think we should require that the police record the race of everyone who stopped. We need to outlaw dangerous police practice like the ones we've talked about, the chokehold and no-knock warrants. We need to provide much more protection against the privilege against self-incrimination. We need to finally reform how police identification procedures are done. All of this is possible. The only question is whether there's the political will to do it. I finished the manuscript for this book in October of 2020, and I was optimistic that the protests following the death of George Floyd that occurred in all 50 states would lead Congress, state legislatures, city councils to adopt police reform legislation. The House of Representatives passed a bill last session and this session, but both times it stalled in the Senate. California's adopted some good laws, some cities have done so, but I'm discouraged that more hasn't been done to reform the police. I worry it's going to take the next tragic death of a black person like George Floyd, the next set of protests across the country, to really make a difference.
Erwin, when there's a mental health crisis, invariably police respond instead of mental health experts, and that often leads to the violence against and oftentimes killing of people, particularly people of color. How do you think that that should be addressed? And also, what do you think of community control of the police?
I think we've turned to the police to take on many tasks that should be done by other social service providers. And so I think, for example, mental health services should be handled much more by trained mental health professionals. Another example, I think it would be desirable to explore having other than the police do traffic stops, because too often the mental health situations or the traffic stops escalate to unnecessary violence. I very much favor community-based policing, and I think there needs to be much more community involvement in controlling policing. One of the things we've learned looking across the country is that community-based policing really does make a difference.
Well, Dean Chemerinsky, we are so thankful that you have joined us today. Your new book, Presumed Guilty, is, I would argue, a must reading for police departments, although I dare say we'll have some trouble getting them to read it. But our listeners certainly should get a copy of Presumed Guilty. And as Marjorie said, it would be wonderful to have all of the law students reading it as well. And we thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder today.
Thank you for the kind words. Thank you for doing this on the book. And I'll hopefully have the chance to see both of you in person before too long.
Take care, Erwin.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Our guest today is water protector, Chicago attorney, Pat Handlin. She's been driving 11 hours north from Chicago to northern Minnesota to represent some of the 900 people who've been arrested for trying to stop Line 3. Line 3 brings the dirtiest oil on earth down from Alberta, Canada, to the shores of the Great Lakes. It is owned by the Canadian corporation Enbridge. Trump issued their permit without any environmental impact statement. The governor of Minnesota or the president of the United States could stop Enbridge, but they haven't. The Line 3 oil pipeline has been operational since October. It goes under 200 bodies of water, including the Mississippi River. Native Americans from the Chippewa and Ojibwe tribe have treaty rights to the land affected by the Enbridge pipeline. Enbridge has a terrible record for oil spills, 194 of them since the year 2000. Since 1986, 7,400,000 gallons have been spilled in the Midwest. Much of it has never been cleaned up. The pipeline goes through sacred land. The land has wild rice, which the Native Americans harvest for nutrition and for valuable spiritual reasons. The land is protected by treaties which have been violated. Tribes are sovereign nations that have entered into these treaties with the United States. A treaty becomes the supreme law of the land. Biden has said that he would honor the treaties, but he has not done so. Attorney Pat Handlin is a criminal defense attorney who represented numerous water protectors facing misdemeanor charges stemming from the Standing Rock No Dakota Area Pipeline movement. She's provided legal support at the hearing challenging TC Energy's permit application to use water for the KXL pipeline, and she has represented water protectors charged in Minnesota for opposition to Line 3. She's been a public defender, a legal services attorney, an administrative law judge on employment discrimination matters. She's represented Occupy Chicago activists, and she's litigated to protect victims of elder abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. Attorney Pat Handlin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good morning.
How dirty is the oil that Enbridge is sending down from Alberta via Line 3?
It is absolutely filthy. It's actually the dirtiest oil on the planet. It is substantially more carbon intensive than other crude oil, and the extraction, processing, and use will even more significantly contribute to carbon pollution and global warming than other oil.
Just how much CO2 does it put into the atmosphere? And I'm wondering, does that have any impact or relationship to the Paris Climate Accords?
Oh, absolutely it does. My understanding is that the 760,000 barrels of oil a day will flow through Line 3, which is a large pipe, about close to a 3-foot pipe in diameter, and it will emit greenhouse gases equal to 50 coal plants, 193 million tons of CO2 per year. And that is actually one of the reasons that President Barack Obama denied the presidential permit for construction of the KXL pipeline, because it's the same oil that would have flowed through KXL. And so it would really negatively impact the Paris Climate Accords. The Minnesota state legislators sent a letter to Biden in February of this year asking him to cancel the permits for Line 3. And they wrote in the letter that it would not be possible to achieve the Paris Climate Accord goals with this pipeline in place.
Was there any feedback from Biden's office with respect to that request on your part, or their part, I should say?
Yeah, their part. Yeah, I'm not in the Minnesota legislature.
Wish you were.
But no, he has the ability to cancel the permit because this pipeline crosses the Canadian-U.S. border. So the president has to authorize, and in fact, Trump did authorize it, but Biden has not rescinded the authorization. He could, but he hasn't.
Pat, let's talk about Enbridge. Who is Enbridge, and what is their track record with respect to protecting the environment? Talk about that, and also talk about the Kalamazoo River spill.
Sure. So Enbridge is a Canadian company. They're one of the originators of the tar sands extraction and movement of that oil from Alberta, Canada. They have a number of different pipelines, but most of them cross into Minnesota and end up at Lake Superior, the shores of Lake Superior. And they have a terrible record of spills. So there's an agency, a federal agency, it's part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's called the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or shorthand, it's called PHMSA. And that agency regulates and monitors hazardous materials pipelines like Enbridge's pipelines. And they keep a website. The website, unfortunately, is very difficult to navigate, but it is possible. They have a lot of data. So according to their website, since 2000, the Enbridge pipeline system, and Line 3 is part of it, had 194 pipeline incidents, they call them their accidents or spills, during which it's called Dilbit, which I can explain to you in a minute. But in the five states bordering Lake Michigan and Lake Superior, there were 194 spills, 70 in Minnesota, 61 in Wisconsin, 21 in Michigan, 19 in Illinois, and 17 in Indiana. And of those 194, they spilled almost 2.5 million gallons of oil from their pipelines. And of that, over 500,000 gallons have never been recovered, because it's really difficult to recover oil from the environment. And that included the Kalamazoo River spill in 2010, which wasn't discovered for 17 hours because their leak detection system is really poor. And so that alone resulted in spilling 843 gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River. And then, since 1986, which was as far back as I could go on the PHMSA website, Enbridge has spilled 7,399,000 gallons of diluted bitumen, or oil, of which 2,351,000 gallons have never been recovered in the states bordering Lake Michigan and Lake Superior.
My God. Pat, who or what agency, if any, could yet veto and stop Line 3?
Well, the president could.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The Army Corps of Engineers also could, they could stop it as well, because they never did an environmental impact assessment, and they could say, wait a minute, we should have done that. And then in Minnesota, there are agencies as well who can stop the flow, or can certainly, are regulatory agencies within the state.
Mm-hmm. And I gather efforts have been made by the people who are opposing this to have that veto, that stoppage, take effect, and either they've been turned down yet, or do they still have more options?
Well, I mean, Biden could do it any time. The Army Corps of Engineers could do it any time. People are still trying to prevent the flow of oil through Line 3, even though, unfortunately, it has now been completed. The construction has been completed. Interestingly, there's a tribal government. I mean, obviously, there's litigation pending also.
Before we get into the situation with the Native American tribes in northern Minnesota, you had mentioned Dilbit, and I wanted you to explain to our audience what Dilbit is and why it's so bad.
The tar sands oil, or the Western Canadian tar sands oil, it's called tar sands, is very thick. It's a really thick, it's so thick it won't flow freely through the pipe. So it's mixed with a substance like naphtha or a gasoline-type substance, which makes it possible, which thins it, makes it possible to flow through the pipe. The problem with that is that it's highly toxic. I mean, the oil is toxic, but adding the naphtha or a gasoline-type substance makes it even more toxic, harder to clean up, and it causes it to, you know, really, it adheres to plants, animals. It's a danger to, it's more flammable, highly flammable. It's much more difficult to clean up. It sticks to the personal protective equipment of the people who are trying to clean it up when there's a spill. So it's called, it's diluted bitumen, so it's shortened to Dilbit.
Pat, I assume that there are Native American tribes, certainly here. There are treaties with the Native American tribes. How have they been impacted? Are they violated and such as a result of what Enbridge is doing with Line 3?
Yes, absolutely. There are tribes in Minnesota. They are the Anishinaabe people, and they're called the Ojibwe and the Minnesota Chippewa tribes. The Minnesota Chippewa tribe is actually a grouping of five bands of Chippewa, Chippewa and Ojibwe. And they, in the 1850s, they entered into treaties with the United States to ceding land to the colonizers, but reserving in the treaties hunting, fishing, and gathering rights in the lands and waters through which Line 3 is routed. And there's a native grain, it's called wild rice. It's called manumen in the language of the tribes. That's been harvested by hand for centuries and is central to, it's part of a deeply held belief that it's a gift from the Creator as well as the land that sustains it, which should be treated with respect and gratitude rather than cultivated and exploited. It's hand harvested every year, used in ceremonies. It's central to the economic, physical, cultural, religious, ceremonial survival of the Minnesota Chippewa. And actually, a lot of tribes eat wild rice. Also, the Lakota were in Minnesota as well. So it's a cherished ritual. And it used to grow, it grows in wetlands. It used to grow in all of Minnesota. Now it grows in the northern part of Minnesota. You can read about it in the Minnesota Chippewa have a website, and there's a Minnesota Chippewa 2018 Tribal Wild Rice Task Force report that's just really describes how important manumen is, not only to the tribes but to the entire environment. It's really an important food for a lot of birds, insects. It has a really positive impact on the aquatic life of the entire ecosystem. So the pipeline has a spill, of course, would be devastating. But even the construction of the pipeline has had negative impacts on the wild rice, because there was a drought there this year, and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources allowed Enbridge, without consulting the tribes, to use over 5 million gallons of water during the time of drought, which is, you know, important to the growth of the wild rice. Also, there were some really serious construction damage during construction. There were 28, it's called frack out, where the pipeline is literally forced under water bodies of water like rivers, and sometimes the process will go wrong and the pipe will break through the ground coming back up and will release what's called a drilling material into the water, which is really harmful to fish and wherever else it. And so the Department of Natural Resources in Minnesota has actually is investigating those incidents. They haven't done anything about it yet. But also the Enbridge pierced an aquifer in January of this year without disclosing it to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, which is monitoring and permitting them. Minnesota Department of Natural Resources learned about it in June, at which point they investigated, learned that over 24 million gallons of groundwater have been released from the aquifer into a wetland. So they actually in September fined Enbridge $3.32 million, ordered the company to stop the flow of water and set up an escrow of $2.75 million to restore the wetland. And Enbridge pierced the aquifer because they dug pilings 18 to 28 feet deep instead of the 8 to 10 feet they represented in their permit application. So this company not only does it have a terrible record of spills, it has a terrible record of not being honest about the process about the incidents that occur even during construction.
I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with attorney Pat Hanlon from Chicago. She's been traveling 11 hours up to northern Minnesota. She's part of the Water Protector Collective, attorneys that are helping with the almost 1,000 people who have been arrested so far dealing with trying to stop Line 3. Pat, how has the Army Corps of Engineers and the state government of Minnesota acted in dealing with the Ojibwa in regard to Line 3?
Well, they haven't really honored the treaties, obviously, as we talked about. I haven't traveled up there for court yet. We've been doing it by Zoom, fortunately, although there are attorneys there who are appearing in person. I will probably have to go there in January, yikes, but anyway. So White Earth Band has sued the Department of Natural Resources in tribal court for allowing that 5 million gallons of water to be used. And that's actually a really kind of a spectacular piece of litigation. There's an attorney named Frank Bibeau, who is a Chippewa member of the tribe in Minnesota, and he has brought that litigation, suing the Department of Natural Resources within tribal court for allowing the use of that water, and that is really groundbreaking, so to speak, litigation. And so the Department of Natural Resources sued the tribe in federal court in Minnesota, seeking an injunction against the litigation, saying that the White Earth Band of Ojibwe did not have authority to sue the Minnesota DNR in tribal court. But interestingly, the federal judge, and they sought an injunction. The federal judge denied the injunction and dismissed their suit, the DNR suit against the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. So, of course, the Minnesota DNR appealed it to the federal appellate court, which in late September denied the appeal. So that case is proceeding. I know, it is great.
Well, Pat, I wonder, because I'm concerned about running out of time, I wonder, this project around Line 3, even though, as you mentioned earlier, I think already 1,000 people or so have been arrested, if not more, it really hasn't gotten as much coverage in the press, certainly as the coverage around Standing Rock. Why do you think that is? This seems to me is equally important, if not more so. What accounts for the fact that it hasn't gotten the media coverage that the earlier fights around Standing Rock and the pipeline there got?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that, because I would try to change that. Perhaps because the struggle in Minnesota is a little more dispersed. There are a number of camps instead of just one camp, where there were over, you know, 13 to 15,000 people. There is brutality happening in Minnesota, so if that was what drew the press to North Dakota, to the Standing Rock struggle, you know, they should be drawn to what's happening in Minnesota, too. Maybe it's not quite as brutal. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what impact, if any, COVID has had on people, but certainly lots of people have gone there, chained themselves to land moving equipment to try to stop the construction, you know, and been arrested. And I do thank you for bringing this to your audience, and so that's one step in trying to...
Yes, and we're proud to do it here on Law and Disorder. We really are, Pat, and are so admiring of your work. Is there a thought as to what our listeners, in fact, perhaps could do to help, who they could write to, what petitions they could sign on to, what websites they could go to? How can our listeners who care about this get involved in trying to stop this?
So the organization, one organization that I'm a member of, is called the Water Protector Legal Collective. We have a website. We're an ongoing organization. We're working to support, you know, to represent the frontline water protectors in Minnesota, who have been peaceful, just as the Standing Rock water protectors were. There's also an organization called Honor the Earth that has been very active in stopping Line 3. And there's an organization called the Ginu Collective, G-I-N-I-W, which is another indigenous-led, woman-led organization. So those organizations have websites. And the other thing I would say is that helps stop Line 3, but wherever your listeners are, there's something happening that they can involve themselves in, even if it's not about Line 3, but to try to stop the extractive industries, the fossil fuel industries, because that's what's obviously destroying the environment.
Pat, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but before we let you go, could you tell our listeners what you're currently working on, and then please share with us your final thoughts?
I'm representing, along with some other lawyers in Chicago and lawyers in Minnesota, a number of water protectors up there who are charged with trespass and other charges. I'm also actively working with Water Protector Legal Collective. Part of what Water Protector Legal Collective does is we have a lot of different things that we do, but one thing is divestment work through our not just our international program, but and that's something else your listeners can do, which is find out where their IRAs and where their investments are, and try and see if they can, or schools, and see if they can divest from companies that are involved in the fossil fuel industry. It's going to take all of us. It's going to take each of us to basically, you know, assure environmental justice for the people most affected by these extractive industries, which are really a lot of indigenous people in the U.S. and worldwide. And so we really need to pay attention and to become active in the struggle for environmental justice for indigenous peoples as well as the entire planet.
Well, Pat Hanlon, you certainly are doing more than your share of that, and I second your hope that the rest of us get involved. If we do half as much or a quarter as much, we further along in this struggle. And thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this important work with us here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this to everyone's attention.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Make sure you never miss an episode by emailing me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so coming up later, all's not well in the beautiful island of Ireland.
It just became more and more clear to us that there was an enormous story to be told. We need to expose what is an awful system in terms of human development.
They only have 0.1% of the world's population, but they became one of the biggest tax havens on the planet. What's that meant for Irish people and their road ahead? I'll speak to authors of a great new book, Tax Haven Ireland. There are lessons in it for citizens everywhere. This month, the Tax Justice Network released its State of Tax Justice Annual Report. Our researchers find that countries are losing $483 billion in tax a year to global tax abuse by multinational corporations and wealthy individuals. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. It's actually much worse than that. The report measures just two things. First, international corporate tax abuse by large multinational corporations using OECD data from country-by-country reports. So that's really big companies with turnover of $750 million and above. And secondly, private tax abuse by rich people, undeclared offshore wealth in secrecy jurisdictions. That lost $483 billion would be enough to fully vaccinate the world's people against COVID three times over. Here's the Tax Justice Network's Alex Cobham.
In some ways, you can read it as a cancelled despair. You know, we find this year that the member countries of the OECD, the richest and most powerful countries in the world, are responsible for more than three quarters of the tax losses imposed globally. And this is the body that the G20 has mandated to fund the solution to the international tax problems we face. It is perhaps unsurprising that the solutions the OECD has put forward this year, and also in previous years, have tended to favour their own members, have tended to point the finger at lower-income countries or less politically connected jurisdictions. But what that's done is lay clear that the countries with power are the same countries that are able to block progress. But we shouldn't feel disheartened. We brought forward with the Global Movement for Tax Justice a set of policy proposals. One of them is to move away from the OECD and towards an intergovernmental body to set tax rules in a genuinely inclusive way under the auspices of the United Nations. Now, just looking at the media coverage of that to get a sense of how this can be influential, in the months before the publication of the State of Tax Justice 2020, the average global media reach for the term UN Tax Convention was about 350,000 per month. Now, the global media reach for that term is 1.7 billion. In other words, it kicked the doors open to the LEBA. That doesn't mean that it's happened, but it certainly helped, I think, the G77 to propose that at the UN again this month. Now, unfortunately, the OECD countries have blocked it, but it's now a live political discussion in a way that it hasn't been, arguably, for some time. I hope the G77 will feel the very strong support of the movement.
So, the member countries at the Rich Country Club of the OECD are responsible for more than three quarters of the tax losses we've looked at. Guess which country is the worst offender? Yep, the UK. It's responsible for more than a third of the world's tax losses. You can check out how your country threatens others and or how it suffers at the hands of other offender nations on our website. I'll put the details in the show notes. As Alex just said, the Rich Country Club of the OECD isn't the only show in town. Here's Pooja Ranjaprasad of the Society for International Development on efforts to bring discussion and decision-making on international tax rules into the United Nations.
The biggest obstacle continues to, of course, be political. And the fact that, you know, we have the kind of same group of OECD countries that are blocking this within the United Nations repeatedly. So that story hasn't really changed. One of the things we hear quite often is sort of this framing of UN versus OECD, which I always find quite strange in terms of framing, because the UN Tax Body and Convention isn't about stopping limited membership bodies from the work that they're doing. It is simply about establishing a principled process of global negotiation, one tax that is inclusive, transparent, and centered around commitments to human rights and gender equality. I think another issue that we hear quite often, at least in the context of OECD processes, really concerns the coordination of developing countries, how that can be improved, how they can represent their collective interests better. And again, in the UN, you have several of those mechanisms already. Now, I mean, many have referred to G77, which is the largest negotiation group of over 130 developing countries. But you also have groupings such as, you know, Asia Pacific Group, Africa Group, Arab Group, Group of Latin America and the Caribbean, CARICOM, which is the Caribbean Community, Small Island Developing States, NDC Group, which is least developed countries, landlocked developing countries, Group of Like-Minded Middle-Income Countries, and so on. So, I mean, the starting point of South-South cooperation in the UN is Global South is not a monolith. Decades of cooperation and countries with extremely limited resources have invested in having a permanent presence in the UN to prioritize international cooperation as well as South-South cooperation. So these are not mechanisms you can just replicate overnight in a vacuum. I mean, they already exist. And these groupings are very important to pool in negotiation capacity, precisely because there is recognition that they don't have the same resources as the other side. And in international negotiations that are fraught with power asymmetries, these groupings become really important. It's a lot harder to stick out your necks as individual countries, and it's much easier to be stronger within these groups. The next point is really about the fact that such important decisions on public revenue is happening in complete secrecy. Is deeply problematic, unacceptable. And so the importance of the UN Tax Convention is really that it would be a process by which we can see what every government and every country's position is. We can assess the negotiation dynamics for ourselves and hold our own governments accountable in that process. So in terms of where we go from here, it really depends on, you know, can we all come together as a global community to really press on how urgent this is?
Can we indeed? That's a very good question. Pooja Rajaprasad of the Society for International Development. Okay, now it's time for the TaskCast special feature. Ireland's economic model has corrupted democracy and business. And there are better ways forward in the public interest. That's according to a brand new book out this month, Tax Haven Ireland. There's a special discount for TaxCast listeners wherever you are in the world. I'll give you the details at the end. So, with me today are the authors of Tax Haven Ireland, Kieran Allen of the School of Sociology, University College Dublin, and Brian O'Boyle, lecturer in economics at St. Angela's College.
We're political activists and we're academics as well. So we want to bring the true nature of Irish capitalism and the true nature of the Irish establishment into the light. Effectively the failure of Irish capitalism. At the centre of the whole thing was an enormous tax haven, and it just became more and more clear to us, especially when we started to look at the official statistics, that there was an enormous story to be told. We needed to expose what is an awful system in terms of human development.
Do you have examples of things that you noticed as citizens, really, of things going bad that kind of really alerted you to all not being well in Ireland?
One was, in 2016, there was an expose where a whole series of vulture funds, or, you know, the international property funds, were all simultaneously declaring their taxes as 250 euros per annum. And we were saying, like, what's this about? So that would be one. I think that's the Apple case was the other one.
Yeah, if you look at the Apple case, I mean, what's interesting about the Apple case is this is one of the biggest corporations in the world, has savings about 200 billion. But when it was set up in Ireland in 1980 initially, it came in on the basis that it wouldn't be paying tax. And then what you find over the years is that it's paying a tax rate of around 2%. But then Apple think that's far too much. And you have these periodic meetings, which the EU Commission eventually gets the minutes of. And you find they keep pressurizing to reduce the tax rate down below 1%. The Irish government has won its appeal. on this issue. But it's only won the appeal on the basis that Apple is not unusual. We don't give preferential treatment to Apple. This happens to a lot of multinationals. And certainly when you look at the tax, the actual tax rates that are paid by multinationals, you find that generally speaking, they're down at around 2-3% and sometimes less.
Yeah, I think the commission is going to appeal that judgment.
Right, and Ireland famously refusing to take the taxes that it was owed is also a really bizarre bizarre situation for a nation state to be in.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, on the one hand, you call, you know, Ireland a cesspit in terms of how you feel that the tax haven model has had its effect in Ireland. But it also is what you call a neoliberal success story, right? So it's really interesting, some of the attitudes. I mean, I used to go to Ireland every Christmas to see my grandparents as a child, and I saw how Ireland was transformed, especially after it joined the European Union. And, you know, you do hear this kind of rhetoric, which is so common also in small island nations. We hear a lot, you know, that after hundreds of years of colonisation, Ireland's entitled to bend the rules. And it's also got its roots so deeply in, you know, very, very strong Christian values, and yet its model really contradicts that. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I would say, if you're absolutely correct, that one of the ways the political elite operates is by using the history of suffering against colonialism to say, okay, we have a right to do what? And you have to spell out what they're doing. They are essentially facilitating multinationals to stop giving a share of their profits to the poor in America, but also crucially to the poor throughout the developing world. And we apparently are entitled to do this because we have suffered so much. So it's this kind of dynamic. And of course, when you operate as a tax haven, I mean, Gabriel Zucman points this out, you will get a higher proportion of your taxes from corporation profits because they tend to be all sucked into this one area. But you've also got to look at the consequences of that. And one consequence of that is that if the corporations don't pay a lot of tax, even if their proportion of tax is relatively high, you have to get the tax from somewhere. And I would say that in Ireland, Irish workers below the wage of, let's say, 40,000 are paying a relatively high rate of tax for very poor public services.
In Ireland, there's 10% of the population, 10% of the tax earners earn over 100,000 euros. So there is an enormous payoff because there's actually quite a few people do very well out of the tax haven. And that's the neoliberal success story. But in the end, a neoliberal success story is often a failure for people's development in the wider society. So we want to say, yes, it's a cesspool if you're an ordinary worker, if you're in the 80% of people who don't benefit from the tax haven.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's a lot of playing around with figures, aren't there, about how many people are actually genuinely employed in Ireland through some of these big US companies, which you wrote about in the book. You talk a lot about the social consequences, not just for the global south that Ireland inflicts on them, but I'm interested as well in how you would kind of place Ireland in terms of the concept of the finance curse. You know, I'm thinking about costs to citizens that have been estimated on citizens, which, you know, £67,000 per head in the UK, estimates of the costs of the City of London, £4.5 trillion in lost economic output in over a 20-year period, as much as $70,000 per head costs in the US over a 15-year period. That's Professor Gerald Epstein's work. I was just wondering how you would look at Ireland from that perspective, and if there's been work done on the finance curse in Ireland.
It is a very useful concept. I suppose the way we tried to approach it was maybe a bit more qualitatively. For example, when we talk about the establishment of the International Financial Services Centre, what they did was they embedded a thing called the Clearinghouse Group right into the centre of the Department of the Taoiseach, which is our Prime Minister. Very, very unusual thing to do, except that what it was about was basically making sure that financial interests had not only the ear, but were actually directly hand in hand making government policy with the elites. So, you know, on the one hand, we're told in Ireland that we live in a republic, that it's based on democracy, that it's transparent and that people have rights, and yet very few people know that for a long period of time, and particularly through all the years of austerity, the corporate elites in the international financial sector and across the various multinationals had a direct say in policy, and that comes through in various types of policy. They gave tax breaks for really rich people. If they were going to bring some of their executives, for example, and they wanted to come and go to private school, they were given up to €50,000 of their income that could be tax-free as a sweetener. Meanwhile, one in five children was going to school hungry in Ireland. And if you'd have said, listen, we're in a really difficult situation here for children's development, we'd like a bit more tax from the very rich and powerful and privileged, you'd have been told, not possible, that can't happen. So in that sense, what they've done is they've corrupted our democracy, and they have ensured that the corporate elite have had the whip hand over people in the country through the various institutions of the state. So that is, in a way, the very definition of the finance course there, I suppose, and it's been writ large in Ireland.
Yeah, I would add to that, just first of all, the Clearinghouse Group. So this is a grouping composed of Bank of America and so on. So the main banks and finance houses, which don't function as a lobby group outside of the state, but are actually embedded in one of the key departments of the state. And what that does is, for example, when it comes to the Tobin tax in Europe, Ireland was I think, one of 11 countries that rejected the idea of a Tobin tax on the advice of the Clearinghouse Group. So that's one example of how the financial curse operates. One other point is the role of accountancy firms. So accountancy firms, we know, have developed in units of tax planning, which in reality we use the term tax dodging. But it's also the case that the way the Irish state functions is often through going back to those same accountancy groups, which are depriving it of money, paying them money for contracts to do research on elements of government policy. So, for example, we find that PwC was commissioned to do a study on what do we do about Ireland's water infrastructure, and they come out with the argument, oh, we have to bring in water charges. So you get these very strange contradictions that really, I would say, fit into the category of the financial curse.
Absolutely, yeah, and we see that in so many economies that are so dominated by the finance sector. You write as well that Ireland has long lacked a strategy for domestic industrialisation, and again, that's such a strong element of the finance curse. I was just wondering how you would characterise what we might call the real economy, or, you know, an economy that is not based on financialisation processes, fake foreign direct investment, profit shifting for tax purposes. You know, I'm just thinking Jersey, before it became this disastrous tax haven, once had a significant potato and dairy industry. I mean, how would you characterise Ireland's economy, how it could be or should be?
Tax havens differ, right? So Ireland's a tax haven of a particular type. And its main role is to function as a space for US corporations in particular to dodge taxes, US corporations that are selling in Europe. Now, unlike other tax havens, these US corporations do employ people. So the overall figure in terms of the labor force in Ireland is somewhere between 8 and 10% of labor force is employed by multinationals, mainly American multinationals. So in that sense, there's a real economy as well as a grossly inflated economy through what they call booking in of sales, which don't occur in Ireland. Secondly, there's been a shift in the real economy, even based on the multinationals, from one that was making computers, medical devices, pharmaceuticals are still quite strong in Ireland, to now one that has a growing reliance on social media companies, Facebook and so on. So a lot of the elements come there. And lastly, I would say in terms of what you might call native Irish capitalism, it is still very, very weak. It is over-focused on property, and it relies very heavily on state support in forms of all sorts of hidden subsidies, such as, for example, the state rents out offices from property developers and so on. So in that sense, if you strip away the multinational element, Irish capitalism is quite weak, reliant on the state, and consumes too many subsidies, in my view, from the state itself.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Ireland's position regarding the 15% minimum global corporate tax rate, which was quite interesting. I mean, they insist on adjusting the wording from at least 15%. I can't quite remember how they adjusted the wording now. I was just wondering what was going on there with Ireland, because you've also written about how the model Ireland has been pursuing is really under threat from all sorts of different movements and decision-making that's going on at a multinational level.
I would say, first of all, that Ireland was operating as one of the main if you like, ambassadors for the multinational, trying to get in as much of an amendment as they could. So as you said, they changed the word at the end. And then finally, Ireland agreed formally to the 15% minimum. Now, why does it agree? You have to remember that its particular niche is that it is a respectable tax haven for corporations. It's not like the British Virgin Islands or Bermuda. It markets itself as that. So therefore, it had a vested interest in being seen to be inside the tent rather than outside the tent. But even while being inside the tent, it's the detail, and that the Irish, if you like, political elite are very good at. So what the detail will come down to, 15% of what? Are you talking about 15% of gross profits? Are you talking about 15% of the taxable profits? What's going to be allowed? So they will be in there trying to essentially establish as many loopholes as possible. So in many ways, their adherence to the 15% minimum is a tactical move to maintain their image, but also to get even more for more bargaining once they're inside the tent.
Yeah, I'd add three very quick points. One, it was interesting, they sort of proclaimed that this was a great victory for Ireland, that they had managed to get in a clause at least. And somehow what that says is that, you know, we should celebrate when we undermine the tax base of every other country because Ireland is somehow protecting itself, which is actually completely wrong. Second point is they were worried about the European Union imposing a more unilateral move that will be more difficult for them. So there was always a sense that they were working hand in glove with the American Chamber of Commerce. It was interesting. Originally, the American Chamber of Commerce backed them in their sort of stance of being hesitating around whether they should sign and not sign. And then when it looked like they had to, because in the end, as you know yourself, Naomi, there was lobbying in the States, and they were hoping that if the Republican Party were strong enough in the American Capitol Hill, that that would torpedo the whole thing. And when that looked like it wasn't going to happen, then you had to get in on the last sort of, you know, the ship is leaving, you've got to get on board, as Kieran said. So for those three reasons, that's why they did what they did.
Yeah, it's interesting. You write quite a lot about the International Financial Services Centre, and it's very important. It was established at the height of Thatcherism in the 80s, and you identify it today as not only being behind a lot of the rot that we've been talking about, but also posing ongoing major risks to the Irish economy and therefore to Irish people. You talk about the International Financial Services Centre as currently housing one of the world's major shadow banking networks with trillions in assets managed completely outside the normal banking sector. So I was just wondering, can we talk a bit about that? Because there's a lot of nations that are really busy at the moment setting up their own international finance centres. They're really intent on expanding them. You know, we've got Nairobi, Kigali, Johannesburg. What would your advice be to them? I mean, two questions in one, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Financial Stability Report, that comes out annually, and they've consistently had Ireland near the top in terms of the amount of transactions that are happening that are outside the regulatory system. And it's enormous. I mean, it's 10, 15 times bigger than the Irish economy. And one example we used in the book was a bank called Deep. I'd never heard of it, and I had to look it up even for this because it's not rolling off my tongue, but DEPFA Bank, the German bank. It's not one of your high street banks, but it was an enormously important bank. And they had collapsed in the context of the Great Recession, and it cost German taxpayers 100 billion. Now, 100 billion would be about a half of Irish GDP for a year. Like, it would be an enormous burden. And just by a stroke of luck, that bank had been sold back to German shareholders about a year before it collapsed, and therefore it landed on the German lap rather than the Irish lap. Now, the Irish had enough stuff landing in their lap during the Great Recession, but can you imagine if that was one of the banks that collapsed on their in terms of their responsibility? So, you know, we all know that there's a sense in which prudence means that you should have some democratic oversight of what's happening in finance, and the very opposite happens in the International Financial Services Centre. You know, some people here call it the Wild West, because ultimately they trade on the fact that there's very, very lax regulation and very little transparency. So even from the point of view of prudence, when you don't know what's there and you know it's enormously big, you've got to worry. And then when you have some examples of what's happened in the recent past, you've got to worry even more. And then you think about the instability that's happening around Brexit, the COVID crisis. I mean, you know, just because we don't know about it, that's what COVID has taught us, isn't it? Just because you don't know about something doesn't mean it's not going to upset you. So it's kind of crazy to think that we could just be blasé about that, but it seems the Irish establishment are.
So just briefly, what would you say to those in Nairobi, Kigali, Johannesburg and other places that are busy kind of expanding and setting up their own centres?
I would say they're going down the wrong road. I mean, it's a fool's game. I mean, this is a model of development that's promoted across the world, you know, set up an export processing zone, set up a financial services centre. But as every country is doing that, there's a sort of a race to the bottom where you have to offer some even more tax incentives, more deregulation. And ultimately, it's a loser's game, basically.
Yeah, and you talk about the future not looking that great for the current economic model in Ireland, especially with some of the changes we've talked about a bit coming down the line regarding the arm's length principle, for example, and other things, and Brexit taking one of the EU cheerleaders for tax havenry, the UK out, a natural ally out of the equation. But on the other hand, the UK is now going to be quite a competitor for driving down those standards even further in this race to the bottom. So, I mean, what do you think Ireland needs to do now?
Well, I would say, first of all, why is there dangers ahead? Because Ireland, for many years, got under the radar. It was such a small economy. It wasn't regarded as so important and so on. That is changing. In addition to that, there is what might be called originally back in the 70s, the fiscal crisis of the states. States are having to spend far more money on COVID, on developing their infrastructure. And therefore, there is a certain pressure on states to gather taxes. And there's more of a focus on what's going on here. So the game that the Irish ruling elite played may not work for the future. So what do we recommend doing? Well, we recommend an entirely different political economy model where the state has to play more of an active role to strategically develop. For example, you said, look at the pharmaceutical industry. There are skills that have been established there through working for multinationals. There's no reason why the Irish state cannot help to develop a generic pharmaceutical industry run by the states. We are for a different model of the economy and indeed the development of a green economy based on state-led investment rather than a reliance on multinationals at the moment.
It's very important not to fall into the trap of seeing a tax haven as just tax is one function amongst many. And the Irish establishment, you know, they're sophisticated enough to know that you offer things beyond tax. And one of the things they're offering now is the data center model. And one of the things that they've decided to do is to hedge their bets somewhat in terms of trying to get the multinationals even more embedded by giving them almost unlimited access to the country in terms of data centers. So there's a big controversy now in Ireland because, you know, on the one hand, we hear that there are data centers now that are taking as much electricity as small towns in the state. And then at the same time, we face potential blackouts this winter. And the question is obviously, why are we doing this? And the reason they're doing it is not because it creates jobs, but it's because it continues to allow the Irish state to seem relevant to the big multinationals who are using Ireland for all sorts of purposes. And that gives a complete lie to the idea that they take climate change seriously. What we want is for a just transition. We want the resources that have been built up in this state over 10, 15, 25 years. We want those now redirected into development that actually fulfills our emissions targets, but also gives people some sense that they have a future in the country, because all too many people don't feel that way. So that's possible. I mean, the big barrier really is the corporate power and the undemocratic power of the elites. That's the big barrier. If you could get the corporate sector to pay more in taxes, you could have a much better small and medium-sized industrial policy. But, you know, we would like it to go further, because ultimately, beyond neoliberalism, capitalism itself is destroying the planet.
Yes. So Ireland's supposed 12.5% corporate tax rate gets repeated a lot by Irish people, doesn't it? We know it's very often, as you've said, been much lower, cheating many nations out of their tax revenue. Supposedly now it'll be raised to the global minimum corporate tax rate of 15% for companies with 750 million euros turnover and above, although banks are exempt. Tax is now much more prominently in people's minds than ever before, isn't it? What do you really hope to achieve with this book?
You have to understand, almost every single school child learns the 12.5%, whereas now 15%, but they almost internalize that. So it is a sacred cow, and it is repeated ad nauseum. And, you know, people talk about the Soviet Union and how people are brainwashed and the same message repeated like a one-party state. It's like that here. And therefore, to some extent, this is an iconoclastic book in that we're challenging a myth. So I suppose that the first thing we'd like to do is to get people to think about what is a myth in our view, to undermine the fatalism, sure, we can't do anything else but just give them this, and really to start thinking about how we can have a different economic model to capitalism. That's really what we're trying to do here. We're trying to spell it out in absolute detail, some of the things that are going wrong with this country.
You've been listening to the authors of the brand new book, Tax Haven Ireland, Kieran Allen and Brian O'Boyle on the TaxCast. It's a fascinating and an entertaining read. Should be a set text for schools and universities, and not just in Ireland. There are lessons here that apply to any country in the world. For TaxCast listeners, as I said, there's a 40% discount off the paperback edition or the ebook for wherever you are in the world. Go to the publisher's website, www.plutobooks.com, and enter the code TAX40, all in the show notes. That's it for this edition. I'll be back with you next month.